great big playground. We could go anywhere we wanted, and no one ever had to worry. We made forts and tree houses. We had sword fights with sticks. We played cowboys and Indians and went on jungle expeditions in the wilds of the sticker bushes. When Bennett was a little guy, we used to tie him to a stake, and he'd wail like a banshee. We'd tell him we were going to burn him if he didn't shut up. He was younger than us, and he was fair game. Nice. Boy-type fun, he said. I guess girls don't do that. How could your parents afford a place like this? I thought your father made his money later, in the year since you left. Mom had some money from a trust fund. The down payment was hers. Actually, it wasn't that much money, even for the time. The house was a white elephant. It was on the market for nearly 10 years, and it was empty all that time. The story we heard was that the previous owner had been murdered. It's not like the house was haunted, but it seemed tainted. Nobody could make a deal work. We were told it fell out of escrow 5 or 6 times before my parents came along and bought it. It was big and neglected. The wiring was bad and the plumbing was shot. Daylight was showing through big holes in the roof. Tree rats ran everywhere, and there was a family of raccoons living in the attic. It took him years to pull it all together. In the meantime, Dad's plan was to buy adjacent properties if they came up for sale. What is it now, 15 acres? Is that right? The original parcel was 6. There probably isn't a lot more land available in this area. Is this city land or county? We're right at the upper edges of the city limits. A lot of what you're looking at up there is part of the Los Padres National Forest. The term forest was a misnomer. The arching mountain range above us was overgrown with nettle, ceanothus, pyracantha, and coastal sage scrub. The soil too poor to support many trees. In the higher elevations, a few pines might remain, if the wildfires hadn't reached them. We passed the tennis court, its surface cracked and weedy along the edges. A tennis racket had been tossed to one side, exposed to the elements long enough to warp, its nylon strings sprung. Beyond the tennis court there was a glass-enclosed structure I hadn't seen from the drive. The lines of the building were low and straight, with a red tile roof that had altered with time until its color was the burnt brown of old bricks. What's that? The pool house. We have an indoor pool. Want to see it? Might as well, I said. I trailed after him as he approached a covered flagstone patio. He crossed to the building's darkened windows and peered in. He moved to the door and tried the knob. The door was unlocked, but the frame was jammed and required a substantial push before it opened, with the kind of scrape that set my teeth on edge. You really want to do this? I asked. Hey, it's part of the tour. To me, it felt like breaking and entering, a sport I prefer to get paid for. The sense of trespass was unmistakable, nearly sexual in tone, despite the fact that we'd been given permission to roam. We entered an anteroom that was used to store an assortment of play equipment. Badminton rackets, golf clubs, baseball bats, a rack lined with a full set of croquet mallets and balls, styrofoam kickboards for the pool, and a line of fiberglass surfboards that looked as if they'd been propped against the wall for years. The gardener was currently keeping his leaf blower and a riding mower in the space to one side. While I didn't see any spiders, the place had a spidery atmosphere. I wanted to brush my clothes hurriedly in case something had dropped down and landed on me unseen. The pool was half-filled, and something about the water looked really nasty. The decking around the pool was paved with a gritty-looking gray slate, not the sort of surface you'd want to feel under your bare feet. At one end of the room was an alcove furnished in rattan, though the cushions were missing from the sofa and matching chairs. The air was gloomy, and I could hear the sound of dripping water. Any hint of chlorine had evaporated long ago, and several unclassified life forms had begun to ferment in the depths. "Looks like it's time to fire the pool guy," I remarked. "The gardener probably does the pool when he remembers," Guy said. "When we were kids, this was great." "What did you and Donovan do to Bennett down here? Drown him? Hang him off the diving board? I can just imagine the fun you must have had." Guy smiled, his thoughts somewhere else. "I broke up with a girl once down here. That's what sticks in my mind. Place was like a country club. Swimming, tennis, softball, croquet. We'd invite dates over for a swim, and then we'd end up making out like crazy. Girl in a bathing suit isn't that hard to seduce. Jack was the all-time champ. He was randy as a rabbit, and he'd go after anyone. Why'd you break up with her? I don't remember exactly. Some rare moment of virtue and self-sacrifice. I liked her too much. I was a bad boy back then, and she was too special to screw around with like the other ones. Or maybe odd's the better word. A little nutsy, too needy. I knew she was fragile, and I didn't want to take the chance. I preferred the wild ones. No responsibility, no regrets, no holds barred. Were your parents aware of what was going on down here? Who knows? I'm not sure. They were proponents of the Boys Will Be Boys school of moral instruction. Any girl who gave in to us deserved what she got. They never said so explicitly, but that's the attitude. My mother was more interested in being everybody's pal. Set limits on a kid and you might have to take a stand at some point. She was into unconditional love, which to her meant the absence of prohibitions of any kind. It was easier to be permissive, you know what I mean? This was all part of the 60s feel-good bullshit. Looking back, I can see how much she must have been affected by her illness. She didn't want to be the stern, disapproving parent. She must have known her days were numbered, even though she survived a lot longer than most. In those days, they did chemo and radiation, but it was all so crudely calibrated they probably killed more people than they cured. They just didn't have the technology or the sophisticated choice of treatments. It's different today, where you got a real shot at survival. For her, the last couple of years were pure hell. It must have been hard on you. Pure agony, he said. I was the child most identified with her. Don't ask me why, but Donovan and Bennett and Jack were linked to Dad, while I was my mother's favorite. It drove me wild to see her fail. She was faltering and in pain, going downhill on what I knew would be her final journey. Were you with her when she died? Yes, I was. The rest of them were gone. I forget now where they were. I sat in her room with her for hours that day. Most of the time she slept. She was so doped up on morphine she could hardly stay awake. I was exhausted myself and laid my head on the bed. At one point she reached out and put her hand on my neck. I touched her fingers, and she was gone just like that. So quiet. I didn't move for an hour. I just sat by the bed, leaning forward, with my head turned away from her and my face buried in the sheets. I thought maybe if I didn't look, she might come back again, like she was hovering someplace close and might return to her body as long as no one noticed she'd left. I didn't want to break faith. What happened to the girl you broke up with? Patty? I have no idea. I wrote to her once, but never heard back. I've thought of her often, but who knows where she is now or what's happened to her. It might be the best thing I ever did, especially back then. What a bastard I was. I have a hard time connecting. It's like somebody else was doing it. But you're a good person now. He shook his head. I don't think of myself as good, but sometimes I think I come close to being real. We left the pool house behind, moving temporarily onto the sunny stretch of lawn where I'd watched Jack hit golf balls. We were on the terrace below the house, shadows slanting toward us as we crossed the grass. How do you feel? You seem relaxed, I said. I'll be fine once they get here. You know how it is. Your fantasies are always stranger than reality. What do you picture? He smiled briefly. I have no idea. Well, whatever it is, I hope you get what you need. Me too, but in the long run, what difference does it make? You can't hide from God, and that's the point, he said. For a long time I was walking down the wrong road, but now I've turned myself around and I'm going back the other way. At some point I'll meet up with my past and make peace. We had by then reached the front of the house again. I better scoot, I said. Let me know how it goes. I'll be fine. No doubt, but I'll be curious. As I got into my car and turned the key in the ignition, I watched him head toward the front door with his backpack. I waved as I passed, and then watched him in my rearview mirror as I eased down the drive. I rounded the curve and he was gone from view. It's painful to think of this in retrospect. Guy Malik was doomed, and I delivered him into the hands of the enemy. As I pulled through the gates, I could see a car approach. Bennett was driving. My smile was polite, and I waved at him. He stared at me briefly, and then glanced away. Chapter 11. At 10 o'clock Monday morning, I received a call that should have served as a warning. Looking back, I can see that from that moment on, troubles began to accumulate at an unsettling rate. I'd gotten a late start, and I was just closing the front gate behind me when I heard the muffled tone of the telephone ringing in my apartment. I did a quick reverse, trotting down the walkway and around the corner. I unlocked the front door and flung it open in haste, tossing my jacket and bag aside. I snatched up the receiver on the fourth ring, half expecting a wrong number or a market survey now that I'd made the effort. "Hello?
Kinsey, this is Donovan."
"Well, hi, how are you? Phew, excuse the heavy breathing. I was already out the door and had to run for the phone." Apparently, he wasn't in the mood for cheery chit-chat. He got straight to the point.
"Did you contact the press?"
It was not a subject I expected the man to broach at this hour or any other. I could feel a fuzzy question mark forming over my head while I pondered what he could possibly be talking about. "Of course not. About what?"
"We got a call from the dispatch about an hour ago. Somebody tipped off a reporter about Guy's return."
"Really? That's odd. What's the point?" I knew the Santa Teresa dispatch occasionally struggled to find noteworthy items for the local section, but Guy's homecoming hardly seemed like a big-time news event. Aside from the family, who'd give a shit?
"They're playing it for human interest, rags to riches. You know the tack, I'm sure. A lowly maintenance worker in Marcella, California, suddenly finds out he's a millionaire and comes home to collect. It's better than the lottery, given Guy's personal history, as you well know."
"What do you mean, as I well know? I never said a word to the press. I wouldn't do that."
"Who else knew about it? No one in the family would leak a story like that. This is a sensitive issue. The last thing we need is publicity. Here we are trying to hammer out some kind of understanding between us, and the phone hasn't stopped ringing since the first call came through."
"I don't follow. Who's been calling?"
"Who hasn't?" he said, exasperated. "The local paper, for starters, and then the L.A. Times. I guess one of the radio stations got wind of it. It'll go out on the wire services next thing you know, and we'll have 6 friggin' camera crews camped in the driveway."
"Donovan, I swear, if there was a leak, it didn't come from me."
"Well, someone spilled the beans, and you're the only one who stands to benefit."
"Me? That makes no sense. How would I benefit from a story about Guy?"
"The reporter who called mentioned you by name. He knew you'd been hired, and he was interested in how you'd gone about finding Guy after all these years. He as good as told me he intended to play that angle. Local PI locates heir missing 18 years. It's better than an advertisement for all the work you'll get."
"Donovan, stop it. That's ridiculous. I'd never blab client business under any circumstance. I don't need more work. I have plenty." This was not entirely true, but he didn't need to know that. The bottom line was, I'd never give client information to the media. I had a reputation to protect. Aside from ethical considerations, this was not a profession where you wanted to be recognized. Most working investigators keep a very low profile. Anonymity is always preferable, especially when you're inclined, as I am, to use the occasional ruse. If you're posing as a meter reader or a florist delivery person, you don't want the public to be aware of your true identity.
"I mean, think about it, Donovan. If I'd actually given him the story, why would he be quizzing you about my methods? He'd know that already, so why would he ask you?"
"Well, you might have a point there, unless he was looking for confirmation."
"Oh, knock it off. You're really stretching for that one."
"I just think it's damn suspicious that you got a plug."
"Who's the reporter? Did you ask where he got his information?"
"He never gave me the chance."
"Well, let me put in a call to him. Why don't we just ask him? It might be something simple or obvious once you hear. You remember his name?"
"Katzen something. But I don't think it's smart for you to talk to him."
Katzenbach. I know Jeffrey. He's a nice man.
Donovan plowed on, not wanting to yield his ground. I'm telling you, lay off. I don't want you talking to him about anything. Enough is enough. If I find out you're behind this, I'll sue your ass from here to next Tuesday, he said, and banged down the receiver on his end.
The screw you, I offered snappishly, came half a second too late, which was just as well.
The minute he'd broken the connection, my adrenaline shot up. My mouth was dry, and I could feel my heart begin to pound in my ears. I wanted to protest, but I could see how it looked from his perspective. He was right about the fact that I was the only one outside the family who knew what was going on. More or less, I thought, pausing to correct myself. Myrna could have tipped the paper, but it was hard to see why she'd do such a thing. And, of course, Peter and Winnie knew what was going on. But again, why would either one of them want to make the matter known? I had a strong impulse to pick up the phone and call Katzenbach, but Donovan's admonition was still ringing in my ears. Once in touch, I was worried the reporter would start pumping me for information. Any comment I made might be quoted in a follow-up, and then my credibility would be shot for sure. Dimly, I wondered if Guy could have tipped off the paper himself. It seemed unlikely, but not impossible, and I could see a certain canny logic if the move was his. If the issue of his inheritance became public knowledge, his brothers would have a hell of a time trying to screw him out of it. The problem with that notion was that Guy had never demonstrated much interest in the money, and he certainly hadn't seemed concerned about protecting his share. Could he be as devious and manipulative as his family claimed? I snagged my jacket and my handbag and headed out again. I tried to shake off my anxiety as I walked the short distance to my car, which was parked half a block down. There was no way to convince the Malicks of my innocence. Accused of the breach, I found myself feeling apologetic, as if I'd actually been guilty of violating the family's trust. Poor Guy. In the wake of my denial, they'd probably turn on him. By the time I reached the downtown area, I'd managed to distract myself, wondering if I'd find a parking space within a reasonable radius of Lonnie Kingman's building. I tried the spiral approach, like a crime scene investigation, starting at the inner point and working outward. If nothing opened up, I could always use the public parking lot, which was 3 blocks away. The second time I circled, I saw a van pull into the stretch of red-painted curb in front of the building. The door on the passenger side slid back, and a fellow with a camcorder swung himself out on the walk. The slim blonde who anchored the 6 o'clock news hopped down from the front seat and scanned the numbers on the building, verifying the address from a note on her pad. Coming up from behind, I couldn't see the logo on the side of the van, but it had an aerial on top that looked fierce enough to receive messages from outer space. Oh, shit. As I passed the van, I could see KEST-TV painted on the side. I resisted the urge to speed away as the woman threw a glance in my direction. I peered to my left, turning toward the building across the street. I waved merrily at someone emerging from the Dean Witter office. Maybe the press would mistake me for a cruising mogul with some money to invest. I kept driving, eyes pinned on my rearview mirror as the cameraman and his companion went into the entranceway. Now what? I didn't like the idea of skulking in the bushes like a renegade. Maybe I was being paranoid and the crew was on its way to cover something else. I drove several blocks before I spotted a payphone on the corner. I left my car at the curb, dropped a quarter in the slot, and dialed Lonnie's private line. He must have been in court because Ida Ruth picked up, thinking it was him.
Yes, sir.
Ida Ruth, this is Kinsey. Did a TV crew show up looking for me? I don't think so, but I'm back here at my desk. Let me check with Allison up front. She put me on hold for a moment and then clicked back in. I stand corrected. They're waiting for you in reception. What's going on?
It's too complicated to explain. Can you get rid of them?
Well, we can get them out of here, but there's no way we can keep them from hanging around on the street outside.
What did you do, if I may be so bold?
Nothing, I swear. I'm completely innocent.
Right, dear, good for you. Stick to that, she said.
Ida Ruth, I'm serious. Here's the deal, I said. I filled her in briefly and heard her cluck in response. My, oh my, if I were you, I'd lay low. They can't stay long. If you tell me how to reach you, I'll call you when they're gone. I'm not sure where I'll be. I'll check back in a bit. I put the receiver down and scanned the street corner opposite. There was a bar on the corner that appeared to be opening. I could see a neon light in the window blink on. As I watched, a fellow in an apron opened the front door and kicked the doorstop into place. I could always hang out in there, drinking beer and sniffing secondhand smoke while I figured out what to do next. On the other hand, come to think of it, I hadn't done anything, so why was I behaving like a fugitive? I fished around in the bottom of my bag and came up with a second coin. I put a call through to the dispatch and asked for Jeffrey Katzenbach. I didn't know him well, but I'd dealt with him on a couple of occasions in the past. He was a man in his 50s whose career had been stalled by his appetite for cocaine and Percocet. He'd always been sharp if you caught him early in the day, but as the afternoon progressed, he became harder to deal with. By nightfall, he could still function, but his judgment was sometimes faulty, and he didn't always remember the promises he'd made. 2 years ago, his wife had left him, and the last I'd heard, he'd finally straightened up his act with the help of Narcotics Anonymous. Guy Malik wasn't the only one who'd undergone personal transformation. When I got through to Katzenbach, I identified myself and we exchanged the usual pleasantries before getting down to business. Jeffrey, this is strictly off the record. The Maliks are my clients, and I can't afford to be quoted.
Why? What's the problem?
There isn't any problem. Donovan's pissed off because he thinks I called you and spoiled the family reunion.
Sorry to hear that.
How'd you get wind of it, or is this a confidential source?
Nothing confidential about it. There was a letter on my desk when I got in last night. We've always encouraged our subscribers to get in touch if they think there's a story we might not have heard about. Sometimes it's just trivia or crank stuff, but this one grabbed my attention.
Who sent the letter?
Some fellow named Max Outhwaite, with an address on Connecticut, out in Colgate. He thought it was an item worth bringing to our attention.
How'd he hear about it?
Beats me. He talked like he'd known them all for years. Basically, the letter says a search was conducted, and Bader Malik's son Guy was located after an absence of 18 years. That's correct, isn't it? I mean, tell me I'm wrong and I'll eat my jockey shorts.
You're correct, but so what?
So nothing. Like he says, here's this fellow working as a janitor in some backwater town, finds out he's inheriting $5 million. How often does that happen? He thought the community would be interested. I thought it sounded like a winner, so I put a call into the Maliks. The number's in the book. It didn't require any red-hot detective work. I talked to Mrs. Malik. What's her name, Christy? Who confirmed the story before I even got to Donovan. Sure enough, that's the deal, unless there's something I missed.
And I was mentioned by name?
You bet. It's one of the reasons I figured it was on the up and up. I tried to reach you last night, but all I got was your answering machine. I didn't bother to leave a message. I figured you were on your way over there to help them celebrate.
How'd you find the guy?
Outhwaite's letter says you got a lead on him through the DMV.
I don't believe this. Who is this man, and where is he getting his information?
How do I know? He acted like he was maybe a friend of the family. You never talked to him yourself?
Jeffrey, knock it off. I didn't call so you could pump me. I'm trying to persuade the Maliks I didn't leak this thing.
Too bad you didn't. You could have filled in the details. I went back to check with Outhwaite, and the guy doesn't exist. There's no Outhwaite in the phone book, and no such house number anywhere on Connecticut Avenue. I tried a couple of other possibilities, and I came up with blanks. Not that it matters, as long as the story's legitimate. I got confirmation from the family.
What about the L.A. Times? How did they get wind of it?
Same way we did. Outhwaite dropped him a note, almost like a press release. It's been a slow week for news, and we're always on the lookout for human interest stuff. This was better than a little lost kitty cat trapped in a well. I thought it was worth pursuing, especially when I saw you were involved.
I wished you'd done some fact-checking with me along the way.
Why? What's the problem?
There isn't any problem, I said irritably. I just think the family might appreciate a little privacy before the whole world rushes in. By the way, Jeffrey, I've heard you tippy-tapping on your keyboard ever since we started this conversation. I told you this is off the record.
What for? It's a nice story. It's a great fantasy. What's the deal with the Maliks? Why are they so pissed with the coverage? We did front page, second section when Bader Malik died. He was an important figure in the community, and they were happy to have the tribute. What's so hush-hush about Guy? Are they trying to cut him out of his inheritance or something?
I rolled my eyes skyward. The man couldn't help but press for information.
Listen, buddy, I'm as clueless as you. What about the letter? What happened to it?
It's sitting right here.
You mind if I have a copy? It would go a long way toward restoring my credibility. I feel like a fool having to defend myself, but I have a reputation to maintain.
Sure, I can do that. I don't see why not.
We're interested in Guy's perspective if you can talk him into it.
I'm not trading, but I'll do what I can.
Terrific. What's your fax number?
I gave him the number of Lonnie Kingman's machine, and he said he'd fax the letter over. If I located Max Southwaite, Jeffrey wanted to talk to him.
Fair enough.
I said I'd do what I could. It didn't cost me anything to profess my conditional cooperation. I tried not to be too profuse in my thanks. It's not like I planned to take the letter straight to Donovan, but I was curious about the contents and thought it made sense to have a copy for my files. At some point, Katzenbach would extract something from me in return. But for now, I was fine. I didn't believe Guy would agree to an interview, but maybe he'd surprise me.
I got back in my car and drove over to the public parking lot. From there, I hoofed it to the office on foot. There was no sign of the KEST-TV van out front. I took the stairs two at a time and entered Kingman and Ives through an unmarked door around the corner from the main entrance. In the back of my mind, I was mulling over the possibility that maybe Bennett or Jack had taken the letter to the dispatch. I couldn't see what it would net either of them, but someone had an interest in seeing Guy's homecoming splashed across the news, and it was someone who knew more than I was comfortable with. Again, I could feel the faint nudge of uneasiness. Darcy Pascoe's computer search had been a bit of a fudge. I hoped she wasn't going to find herself in trouble as a result of my request. I checked the fax machine in Lonnie's office and found the copy of Max Southwaite's letter sitting in the slot as promised. I went to my office, reading as I went. Dear Mr. Katzenbach, thought you'd be interested in a modern-day Cinderfella story taking place right here in Santa Teresa. As I recall, you're the reporter who wrote about Bader Malik's death last month. Now, word around town has it that his probate attorney hired a private investigator, a female no less, to locate his missing son, Guy. If you've been around town as long as me, you'll remember that as a youngster, Guy Malik was caught in a number of scrapes and finally disappeared from the local scene nearly 20 years ago. You'd think finding someone like that after all this time would prove daunting, but Milhone, the aforementioned female detective, ran a DMV check and turned him up in less than 2 days. Seems he's been up in Marcella ever since he left, and he's working as a janitor in a church up there. He's one of those born-agains who probably didn't have two nickels to rub together, but his father's death has turned him into an instant millionaire. I think people would be heartened to hear how he's managed to turn his life around through his Christian faith. Folks might also enjoy hearing what he's planning to do with his newfound riches. With all the bad news that besieges us from day to day, wouldn't this story give everyone a nice lift? I think it would be a wonderful inspiration to the community. Let's hope Guy Malik is willing to share the story of his good fortune with us. I look forward to reading such an article, and know you'd do a fine job of writing it. Best of luck and God bless. Sincerely yours, Max Southwaite, 2905 Connecticut Avenue, Colgate, California. I noticed I held the letter by the corners, as if to avoid smudging prints. A ridiculous precaution given the fact that it wasn't even the original. The note was neatly typed, with no visible corrections and no words X'd out. Granted, there were spelling errors, including my name, an excessive use of commas, a tendency toward the emphatic, and a bit of unnecessary capitalization. But otherwise, the intentions of the sender seemed benign. Aside from alerting the press to something that was nobody else's business, I couldn't see any particular attempt to meddle in Guy Malik's life. Maximilian, or perhaps Maxine Outhwaite, apparently thought subscribers to the Santa Teresa Dispatch would be warmed by this story of a bad boy turned good and the resultant rewards. Outhwaite didn't seem to have an axe to grind,
and there was no hint of malice to undercut his or her enthusiasm for the tale.
So what was going on?
I set the letter aside, swiveling in my swivel chair, while I studied it covertly out of the corner of my eye. As a female detective, I found myself vaguely bothered by the damn thing. I didn't like the intimate acquaintance with the details, and I couldn't help but wonder at the motivation.
The tone was ingenuous, but the maneuver had been effective. Suddenly, Guy Malik's private business had been given a public audience.
I placed the letter in the Malik file, turning it over to my psyche for further consideration. I spent the rest of the morning at the courthouse, taking care of other business. As a rule, I'm working 15 to 20 cases concurrently. Not all of them are pressing, and not all demand my attention at the same time. I do a number of background checks for a research and development firm out in Colgate. I also do pre-employment investigations, as well as skip traces for a couple of small businesses in the area. Periodically, I'm involved in some fairly routine snooping for a divorce attorney down the street. Even in a no-fault state, a spouse might hide assets or conceal the whereabouts of communal items, like cars, boats, planes, and minor children. There's something restful about a morning spent cruising through the marriage licenses and death records in pursuit of genealogical connections, or an afternoon picking through probated wills, property transfers, and tax and mechanics liens at the county offices. Sometimes I can't believe my good fortune, working in a business where I'm paid to uncover matters people would prefer to keep under wraps. Paper stalking doesn't require a PI to slip into a Kevlar vest, but the results can be just as dangerous as a gun battle or a high-speed chase. My assignment that morning was to probe the financial claims detailed in a company prospectus. A local businessman had been approached to invest $50,000 in what looked like a promising merchandising plan. Within an hour, I'd found out that one of the two partners had filed for personal bankruptcy, and the other had a total of 6 lawsuits pending against him. While I was about it, I did a preliminary search for Max Outhwaite, starting with voter registration and working my way through local tax rolls. I crossed the street to the public library and tried the reference department. Under that spelling, there were no Outhwaites listed in the local phone books and none in the city directories going back 6 years. This meant nothing in particular as far as I could see. It did suggest that Max Outhwaite was a nom de plume, but under certain circumstances I could relate to the maneuver. If I wanted to call an issue to the attention of the local paper, I might conceivably use a fake name and a phony address. I might be a prominent person, reluctant to have myself associated with the subject in question. I might be a family member, eager to get Guy in trouble, but unwilling to take responsibility. Writing such a letter was hardly a crime, but I might feel guilty nonetheless and not want the consequences blowing back on me. For lunch, I bought a sandwich and a soft drink from a vending machine and sat on a stretch of lawn out behind the courthouse. The day was hot, the treetops buffeted by dry winds coming off the desert. The branches of the big evergreens planted close to the street seemed to shimmer in the breeze, giving off the scent of pitch. I leaned back on my elbows and turned my face up to the sun. I can't say I slept, but I gave a good impression of it. At 1 o'clock, I roused myself and went back to the office where I began to type up my findings for the cases I'd worked. Such is the life of a PI these days. I spend more time practicing my skills with a Smith Corona than a Smith & Wesson.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
Chapter 12. My run that morning had been unsatisfactory. I'd done what needed doing, dutifully jogging 1.5 miles down the bike path and 1.5 miles back. But I'd never developed any rhythm, and the much-sought-after endorphin rush had failed to materialize. I've noticed on days when the run isn't good, I'm left with an emotional itch that feels like anxiety, in this case compounded by mild depression. Short of drink and drugs, sometimes the only remedy is to exercise again. I swear this is not a compulsion on my part, so much as a craving for relief. I drove over to Harley's Beach and found a parking spot in the shelter of the hill. The lot was nearly empty, which surprised me somehow. Usually there's an assortment of tourists and beachcombers, joggers, lovers, barking dogs, and parents with small children. Today, all I spotted was a family of feral cats sunning themselves on the hillside above the beach. I staggered across an expanse of loose, dry sand until I reached the hard pack at the water's edge. I would have pulled off my shoes and socks, rolling up my pant legs so I could jog in the surf. However, someone had recently given me a small book about tide pools. I'd leafed through with interest, imagining myself in the role of inquisitive naturalist, poking among the rocks for tiny crabs and starfish, though their undersides are completely disgusting and gross. Until I read this colorful, informative pamphlet, I'd had no idea what strange, ugly beasties existed close to shore. I'm not the kind of person who sentimentalizes nature. The outdoors, as far as I can see, is made up almost entirely of copulating creatures who eat one another afterward. To this end, almost every known animal has developed a strategy for luring others within range. Among life forms in the sea, some quite minuscule, the tactic involves thorny parts or pincers, or tiny three-jawed mouths, or trailing stingers, or vicious suckers with which they latch onto one another, causing painful death and dismemberment, all in the name of nourishment. Sometimes the juice is slurped out of the victim long before death occurs. The starfish actually takes out its own stomach, enfolds its live prey, and digests it outside its body. How would you like to put your bare foot down on that? I ran in my shoes, splashing through the surf when the waves came close. Soon my wet jeans clung to my legs, the heavy fabric cold against my shins. My feet were weighted as though with stones, and I could feel the sweat begin to soak through my shirt from the labor of the run. Despite the damp breeze coming off the ocean, the air felt oppressive. For the third day in a row, Santa Ana winds were blasting in from the desert, blowing down the local canyons, pulling moisture from the atmosphere. The mounting heat collected degree by degree, like a wall of bricks going up. My progress felt slow, and I forced myself to focus on the sand shimmering ahead of me. Since I had no way to measure distance, I ran for time, jogging 30 minutes north before I turned and jogged back. By the time I reached Harley's Beach again, my breathing was ragged, and the muscles in my thighs were on fire. I slowed to a trot, and then geared down to a walk as I returned to my car. For a moment, I leaned panting against the hood. Better. That was better. Pain was better than anxiety any day of the week, and sweat was better than depression. Home again, I left my soggy running shoes on the front steps. I padded upstairs, peeling out of my damp clothes as I ascended. I took a hot shower, and then slipped into a pair of sandals, a t-shirt, and a short cotton skirt. It was now close to 4, and there was no point returning to the office. I brought in the mail and checked for phone messages. There were 5. 2 hang-ups, 2 reporters who left numbers, asking me to get back to them. And a call from Peter Antle, the pastor of Guy's Church. I dialed the number he'd left, and he picked up so fast I had to guess he'd been waiting by the phone. "Peter, I got your message. This is Kinsey in Santa Teresa."
"Kinsey, thanks for being so prompt. Winnie's been trying to call Guy, but she can't seem to get through. The Malicks have the answering machine on, and nobody's picking up. I don't know what Guy's plans are, but we thought we'd better warn him. There are reporters camped out at the gas station across from his place. We have people knocking on the church door and a pile of messages for him."
"Already?"
That was my reaction. Frankly, I don't understand how this got out in the first place.
"Long story. I'm still in the process of looking into it. I know the family was contacted by the local newspaper first thing this morning. The reporter here had had a letter delivered to him at the paper. I guess something similar was sent to the LA Times. I haven't seen the news yet, but I have a feeling it's going to get bigger before it goes away."
"It's even worse up here. The town's so small, none of us can manage to avoid the press. Do you have a way to get in touch with Guy? We're here for him if he needs us. We don't want him to lose his footing in the stress of the situation."
"Let me see if I can find a way to get through. I guess this is his 15 minutes of fame, though frankly I can't understand why the story's generating so much attention. Why should anyone give a fat rat's ear? He doesn't even have the money yet, and who knows if he'll ever see one red cent."
I could almost see Peter's grin. Everyone wants to believe in something. For most people, a big windfall would literally be the answer to all their prayers.
I suppose so, I said. At any rate, if I reach him, I'll have him give you a call.
I'd appreciate that.
After we hung up, I flipped on the TV set and tuned in to KEST. The evening news wouldn't air for an hour, but the station often ran quick promos for the show coming up. I suffered through 6 commercials and caught the clip I'd suspected would be there. The blonde anchor woman smiled at the camera, saying, "Not all news is bad news. Sometimes even the darkest cloud has a silver lining. After nearly 20 years of poverty, a Marcella maintenance man has just learned he'll be inheriting $5 million. We'll have that story for you at 5. Behind her, the camera showed a glimpse of a haggard-looking Guy Malik, staring impassively from the car window as Donovan's BMW swung through the gates of the Malik estate. I felt a pang of guilt, wishing I'd talked him out of coming down. Given his bleak expression, the homecoming wasn't a success. I picked up the phone again and tried the Malik's number. The line was busy. I called the number every 10 minutes for an hour. The Maliks had probably taken the phone off the hook, or maybe their message tape was full. In either event, who knew when I'd get through to him? I debated with myself briefly and then drove over to the house. The gate was now closed and there were 6 vehicles parked along the berm. Reporters loitered, some leaning against their car fenders, 2 chatting together in the middle of the road. Both men were smoking and held big styrofoam coffee cups. 3 camera units had been set up on tripods, and it looked as if the troops were prepared to stay. The late afternoon sun slanted between the eucalyptus trees across from the Malik property, dividing the pavement into alternating sections of light and shadow. I parked behind the last car and went on foot as far as the call box near the front gate. All activity behind me ceased, and I could feel the attention focus on my back. No one answered my ring. Like the others, I was going to hang around out here, hoping to catch sight of one of the Maliks exiting or entering the grounds. I tried one more time, but my ringing was greeted with dead silence from inside the house. I returned to my car and turned the key in the ignition. Already a dark-haired woman reporter was ambling in my direction. She was probably in her 40s, with oversized sunglasses and bright red lips. As I watched, she fumbled in her shoulder bag and pulled out a cigarette. She was tall and slender, decked out in slacks and a short-cropped cotton sweater. I marveled she could bear it with the heat sitting where it was. Gold earrings, gold bracelets, a daunting pair of 4-inch heels. For my taste, walking in high heels is like trying to learn to ice skate. The human ankle does not take readily to such requirements. I admired her balance, though I realized when she reached me that in bare feet she'd probably be shorter than I. She made a circling motion, asking me to roll down my car window.
"Hi, how are you?" she said. She held up the cigarette. "You have a light for this?"
"Sorry, I don't smoke. Why don't you ask one of them?"
She turned, her gaze sliding back to the 2 men standing in the road. Her voice was husky, and her tone was dismissive. "Oh, them. That's the boys' club," she remarked. "Those 2 won't even give you the time of day unless you have something to trade."
Her eyes flicked back to me.
"What about you? You don't look like a reporter. What are you, family friend? An old sweetheart?"
I had to admire the placid way she eased right into it, casual, unconcerned. She was probably wetting her pants, hoping I'd provide a little tidbit so she could scoop her competition. I started rolling up my window. Quickly, she raised her handbag and turned it sideways, inserting it into the space so the window wouldn't close all the way. There was now a 7-inch gap where her leather bag was wedged.
"No offense," she said, "but I'm curious. Aren't you that private investigator we've heard so much about?"
I turned the key in the ignition.
"Please remove your bag."
I cranked the window down about 1 inch, hoping she'd pull the bag free so I could be on my way.
"Don't be in such a hurry. What's the rush? The public has a right to know these things. I'm going to get the information anyway, so why not make sure it's accurate? I heard the kid spent a lot of time in jail. Was that here or up north?"
I cranked the window up a notch and put the car in gear. I pushed my foot down lightly on the gas pedal and eased away from the berm. She held onto the bag by its strap, walking beside the car, continuing the conversation.
I guess she was accustomed to having the driver at her mercy once she used the old handbag trick. I increased my speed sufficiently to force her into a trot. She yanked the strap, yelling, "Hey!" as I began to accelerate. I couldn't have been driving more than 2 miles an hour, but that's a tough pace to maintain when you're wearing heels that high. I inched my foot down on the gas. She released the bag and stopped where she was, watching with consternation as I pulled away. I passed the two guys in the road who seemed to enjoy the rude comment she was yelling after me. I couldn't hear the words, but I got the drift. In the rearview mirror, I saw her flip me the bird. She removed a high heel and flung it at my rear window. I heard a mild thump on impact and saw the shoe bounce off behind me as I picked up speed. The long strap of the handbag dangled and flapped against the car door. About 100 yards down the road, I paused long enough to roll down my window and give the bag a shove. I left it there in the road, curled like a possum, and drove to my apartment. There were 2 newspapers on the sidewalk when I got home. I picked up both and left one on Henry's back doorstep before I let myself in. I turned on some lights and poured myself a glass of wine, then sat at the kitchen counter and spread the paper out in front of me. The story was in the second section, and the tone was odd. I'd expected a fairy tale version of Guy's life to date, his estrangement from the family, and his subsequent spiritual transformation. Instead, Jeff Katzenbach had patched together, in excruciating detail, an inventory of all the sins from Guy's youth. Countless episodes of reckless driving, vandalism, drunken disorderly conduct, assault and battery. Some charges dated back to his juvenile record and should have been purged or remained sealed by the courts. Where had Katzenbach gotten his information? Some of it, of course, was a matter of public record, but I wondered how he'd known to look. He'd obviously been tipped off by Max Outhwaite's reference to Guy's earlier scrapes. I thought back uneasily to the file of news clippings Bader Malik had kept. Was there any way he could have seen that? This would have been a second leak of sorts. The first was the fact of Guy's return. The second, this detailed criminal history. I noticed Katzenbach had couched his revelations in typical journalistic fudgings. The word alleged appeared about 6 times, along with confidential sources, informants close to the family, former associates, and friends of the Maliks who asked to remain anonymous. Far from celebrating Guy's good fortune, the public was going to end up resenting his sudden wealth. Reading between the lines, you could tell Katzenbach considered Guy Malik an undeserving scoundrel. Somehow his current church affiliation looked self-serving and insincere, the convenient refuge of a culprit hoping to make himself look good in the eyes of the parole board. For supper, I made myself a hot, hard-boiled egg sandwich with lots of mayonnaise and salt, and perched at the counter eating while I scanned the rest of the paper. I must have been more absorbed than I thought, because when the telephone shrilled, I flung my sandwich sideways in response. I snatched up the receiver, heart thumping as though a gun had just been fired in my ear. If this turned out to be a reporter, I was going to hang up. Yes? Hey. Oh, shit. Guy, is that you? You scared the hell out of me. I leaned down and gathered up the remains of my sandwich, popping the crust in my mouth while I licked at my fingers. There was mayonnaise on the floor, but I could tend to that later.
Yeah, it's me. How are you? He said. I tried calling a while ago, but you were out, I guess.
Thank God you called. I was just over at the house, but I couldn't get anyone to answer my ring. What's happening?
We just finished dinner. Have you seen the news?
I have the paper in front of me.
Not so good, huh?
It's not that bad, I said, hoping to cheer him up. It does look like somebody's really got it in for you.
That's my assumption, he said lightly.
Are you all right? Peter called earlier. He's been trying to get in touch, but all he's managed so far is the answering machine. Did you get his message?
No, but why would I? Everybody here is pissed at me. They think I notified the paper, trying to get attention. There's a powwow on for later, after Donovan gets home. He's got a meeting until 9. The delay's making me sick. Reminds me of that old business, you wait until your father gets home and he'll give you the what for.
I found myself smiling. You want me to come get you? I can be there in 15 minutes.
Yes. No. I don't know what I want. I'd like to get out of here, but I don't dare take off with things as they are.
Why not? The damage is done. Whoever spilled the beans made it look as bad as they could. If you'd leaked the news, you'd have put a different spin on it.
How would I manage that? You can't put a different spin on the truth.
Of course you can. It's called politics.
Yeah, but I did all those things. This is just payback time. I told you I was bad. At least, now you know the worst.
Oh, stop that. I don't care about that stuff. All I care about is getting you out of there.
You want to come for a visit? I could sneak out for a few minutes. Jack and Bennett are downstairs, and Christy's in the office going through some of Dad's old papers.
Sure, I can pop back over there. What do you want me to do? Shall I ring from the gate?
No, don't do that. I'll meet you out on Wolf Run Road, he said. If the side gate's locked, I can scale the wall. I'm an expert at getting out. When I was a kid, I used to do it all the time. That's how I managed to get in so much trouble back then.
Why don't you bring your backpack and let me spirit you away, I said. I'll drive you to Marcella, and you can hire an attorney to handle your interests from here on.
Don't tempt me. Right now, all I need is civilized conversation. Park in that little grove of trees just across from the gate. I'll be out there in 15 minutes.
I took a few minutes to tidy up the kitchen, and then I changed into jeans, a dark shirt, and my Reeboks. The evening air felt uncharacteristically warm, but I wanted to be prepared for night maneuvers if need be. Once at the Malik's, I took a quick swing by the front gate. There were now two more news crews, and the gathering had taken on the feel of a vigil outside a prison. Portable lights had been turned on, and a man with a microphone spoke directly to a camera, making gestures toward the house. I saw the dark-haired reporter, but she didn't see me. She seemed to be bumming a light for her cigarette from a poor, unsuspecting source. I followed the wall, circling the property as I turned left on Wolf Run. I spotted the gate, a dark blot in an otherwise unbroken expanse of wall. I pulled off onto the berm across the road, gravel crackling under my wheels. I shut down the engine and sat there, listening to the tick of hot metal and the murmur of the wind. There weren't any street lamps along this section of the road. The high night sky was clear, but the moon had been reduced to the merest sliver, a frail curve of silver in a sky pale with stars. The dust in the air was as fine as mist. In the ambient light, the pavement was a dull, luminous gray. The stucco wall enclosing the Malik property had been robbed of its pink luster and stretched now like a ghostly band of drab white. June and July were traditionally dry, and I associated the Santa Ana winds with the end of summer, late August, early September, when the fire danger was extreme. For years, January had been the rainy season, 2 weeks of rain that we hoped would fill our annual quota. Yet here we were with the dry wind tossing in the treetops. The bend and sway of tree boughs set up a hushed night music, accompanied by the rustling percussion of dry palm fronds, the occasional snap of tree limbs. By morning, the streets would be littered with dead leaves and the small withered skeletons of broken branches. The gate opened without a sound, and Guy emerged head down. He wore a dark-colored jacket, his fists shoved into his pockets as though he were cold. I leaned over and unlocked the door on the passenger side. He slid into the seat and then pulled the door shut without slamming it. He said,
"Hey, thanks for coming. I thought I'd go crazy without a friendly face. I'd have called you before, but they were watching me like a hawk."
"No problem. I don't know why you don't break and run while you can."
"I will, tomorrow. Or maybe the day after that. I told you we're supposed to have another meeting tonight just to talk about some things."
"I thought you already talked."
"Well, we did. We do. Every time I turn around, we have another chat."
"That's because you haven't knuckled under yet," I interjected.
"I guess that's it."
He smiled in spite of himself. His tension was contagious, and I could have sworn I smelled alcohol on his breath. I found myself with my arms crossed, one leg wound around the other as if to protect myself. "I feel like we're having an affair," I said.
"Me too. I used to meet girls out here in the old days when I was grounded. I'd slip over the wall and we'd screw in the back seat of a car. There was something about the danger set me on fire. And them too. Made most of them seem more interesting than they were."
"I know this is none of my business, but have you been drinking?" I asked.
He turned and looked out the passenger window, shrugging.
I had a couple of drinks last night before all this shit came down. I don't know what got into me. Don't get me wrong, they were being nice at that point, but you could tell they were nervous, and so was I. I'm ashamed to say this, but the alcohol did help. It mellowed us out and smoothed the conversation. Tonight was pretty much the same, except everybody's mood was different. Cocktail hour comes along, and those guys really hit it.
Bennett and his martinis.
You bet. I figure that's the only way I'll get through. Peter wouldn't be too happy with me, but I can't help it. I can feel myself sliding back to my old ways.
What did you think of Christy?
She was nice. I liked her. I was surprised at Bennett, at the weight he'd put on. But Jack seemed the same, still nuts about golf. And Donovan hasn't changed.
What have they said to you so far?
Well, we talked some about the money. What else? I mean, the subject does come up. It's like Donovan says, we can't just ignore the issue. It's like this big dark cloud hanging over us. I think we were all uncomfortable at first.
Have you resolved anything?
Well, no, nothing much. At first I think they were wondering, you know, generally about my attitude. Now anything I say and everybody jumps right on it. Tell you the truth, I'd forgotten what they're like.
How do they seem to you?
Angry. Underneath it all, they're pissed. I keep feeling the anger coming up inside me, too. It's all I can do to keep a lid on it.
Why bother? Why not blow? The three of them certainly don't hesitate.
I know, but if I flip my lid, that's only going to make matters worse. I'm trying to show them I've changed, and then I find myself feeling like I always did. Like I want to smash lamps, throw a chair through a window, get stoned or drunk or something bad like that.
That must be a trial.
I'll say. I mean, literally. All I can think about is maybe this is some kind of test of my faith.
Oh, it is not, I said. It may be a test of your patience, but not your faith in God. He shook his head, pressing his hands down between his knees.
Let's talk about something else. This is making me so tense I could fart.
I laughed and changed the subject. For a while we chatted about inconsequential matters. Hunched there in the front seat, I was reminded of the occasional dates I had in high school, where the only hope of privacy was remaining closed away in some kid's car. On chilly evenings, the front windshield would fog up, even if all we did was talk. On warm nights like this, we'd sit with the windows rolled down, radio tuned to some rock and roll station. It was Elvis or the Beatles, clumsy moves and sexual tension. I don't even remember now what we talked about, those lads and I. Probably nothing. Probably we drank purloined beer, smoked dope, and thought about the incredible majesty of life.
So what else is going on, aside from interminable meetings, I asked.
Like a rough place on a fingernail, I couldn't resist going back to it. Apparently, Guy couldn't resist it either, because we fell right into the subject again. This time he smiled, and his tone seemed lighter.
It's nice to see the house. I found some letters of my mother's, and I read those today. She's the only one I ever missed. The rest of them are a waste.
I don't want to say I told you so, but I did predict this.
I know, I know. I thought we could just sit down like grown-ups and clean up some old business, but it doesn't really happen like that. I mean, I keep wondering if there isn't some kind of defect in me, because everything I do just seems to come out wrong. Whatever I say seems off, you know? They look at me like I'm speaking in tongues, and then I see them exchange these looks.
Oh, I know that one. Jack and Bennett are big on flicking looks back and forth.
That's the easy part, but there's worse.
Like what?
I don't even know how to describe it. Something under the surface. Something slides right by and no one owns up to it. So then I start questioning my own thought process. Maybe I'm nuts and it's not them after all.
Give me an example.
Like when I told them I'd like to give something to the church? I honestly don't want the money for me. I mean that. But Jubilee Evangelical saved my life, and I want to give something back. To me, that doesn't seem so wrong. Does it seem wrong to you?
No, not at all.
So, I say that, and all of a sudden we're in the middle of a power play. Bennett saying how it really doesn't seem fair. You know, how he talks with that slightly pompous air of his. Our family's never been religious. Dad worked for the good of us all, not for the benefit of some church he never heard of.
He
He says it all in this completely rational tone, and pretty soon I wonder if what I want to do is right after all. Maybe they have a point, and my values are screwed up.
Sure they have a point. They want you to relinquish all claim so they can divide up your portion among themselves. They know perfectly well you're entitled to a quarter of his estate. What you do with your share is none of their business.
But how come I end up the magnet for all that rage?
Guys, stop. Don't do that. That's the third time you've said that. Don't get into self-blame. The gamesmanship has obviously been going on for years. That's got to be why you left in the first place, to get away from that stuff. I swear they were behaving the same way before you showed up.
You think I should leave?
Well, of course I do. I've said it all along. You shouldn't take their abuse. I think you should get the hell out while you have the chance.
I wouldn't call it abuse.
Because you're used to it, I said. And don't get sidetracked. Your brothers aren't going to change. If anybody goes down for the count, it's going to be you.
Maybe so, he said. I don't know. I just feel like I have to stay since I've come this far. If I cut and run, we're never going to find a way to work this through.
I can tell you're not listening, but please, please don't agree to anything without talking to an attorney first.
Okay. Promise me. I will, I swear. Well, I gotta go before somebody figures out I've escaped.
Guy, you're not 16. You're 43 years old. Sit here if you want. You can stay out all night. Big whoop-de-doo. You're an adult.
He laughed. I feel like I'm 16. And you're cute.
He leaned over quickly and brushed my cheek with his lips. I could feel the soft scratch of his whiskers against my face, and I caught a whiff of his aftershave. He said,
bye-bye, and thanks.
Before I could respond, he was out of the car, shoulders hunched up against the wind as he moved to the gate. He turned and waved, and then he was swallowed up by the dark. I never saw him again. Chapter 13. Guy Malik was killed sometime Tuesday night, though I didn't actually hear about it until Wednesday afternoon. I'd spent most of the day over at the courthouse sitting in on the trial of a man accused of embezzlement. I hadn't been associated with the case. Undercover cops had nailed him after 7 months of hard work. But some years before, I'd done surveillance on him briefly at the request of his wife. She suspected he was cheating, but she wasn't sure with whom. Turned out he was having an affair with her sister, and she broke off relations with both. The man was dishonest to the core, and I confess I found it entertaining to watch the legal system grind away at him. As often as I complain about the shortage of justice in this world, I find it infinitely satisfying when the process finally works as it should. When I got back to the office after court adjourned, there was a message from Tasha waiting on my machine. I noticed in passing it was the Malik's number she'd left. I called, expecting to have Myrna pick up. Instead, Tasha answered as if she'd been manning the phones. The minute I heard her, I realized how irritated I was that she'd gone out of town just as Guy arrived. If she'd been doing her job, she might have steered the family off their campaign of pressure and harassment. Smart mouth that I am, I launched right in. At long last, I said, it's about time you got back. All hell's broken loose. Have you heard what's going on? Well, obviously you have, or you wouldn't be there. Honestly, I adore Guy, but I can't stand the rest of them. Tasha cut in, her voice flat. Kinsey, that's why I called. I cut my trip short and flew back from Utah this afternoon. Guy is dead. I was silent for a beat, trying to parse the sentence. I knew the subject, Guy, but the predicate, is dead, made no immediate sense. You're kidding. What happened? He can't be dead. When I saw him on Monday, he was fine. He was murdered last night. Somebody smashed his skull with a blunt instrument. Christy found him in bed this morning when he didn't come down for breakfast. The police took one look at the crime scene and got a warrant to search the premises. The house has been swarming with cops ever since. They haven't found the murder weapon, but they suspect it's here. They're still combing the property. I kept getting hung up about two sentences back. Somebody killed him in bed? While he slept?
It looks that way.
That's disgusting. That's awful. You can't be serious.
I'm sorry to spring it on you, but there isn't any nice way to put it. It is disgusting. It's terrible. We're all numb.
Has anybody been arrested?
Not at this point, she said. The family's doing what they can to cooperate, but it doesn't look good.
Tasha, I don't believe this. I'm sick.
I am.